Looking back at main news headlines for June 2017. So much is happening this week in the news that it's almost hard to think back over the rest of the month. But this has been one of those months in which the news just keeps coming. Earlier on, it was Senator Angus King in the spotlight as he made headlines with his questioning of national security leaders. The next week, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke visited Maine and hinted that the Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument may transition to a national park instead of a national monument. Earlier this week, Senator Susan Collins announced her opposition to the GOP health care bill and yesterday tweeted her frustration with comments made by President Trump. And all of this has been happening as the Maine legislature struggles to come up with a new state budget. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, looking back at the month of June. Share what mattered most to you. But first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Where to begin today's wrap-up of the month's news? We could start in Washington, D.C., and the role Maine's two U.S. senators are playing in the debate over health care reform and the investigation into Russia's influence in U.S. elections. Maybe we should begin in the Katahdin region and the visit by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. But no, we will begin in Augusta, where a government shutdown looms large. With me in the studio today for our Month in Review program, Greg Kesich. He is editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and the Maine Sunday Telegram. Brian Kevin is managing editor of Down East Magazine. And joining us from our Augusta studio, Steve Missler, the Maine Public Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief. As always, we want to hear from you. Which stories are you following most closely this month and why? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk at mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. What a day and what a morning. We're going to start with you, Steve Missler, in Augusta. We just heard Mal Leary's piece. So an agreement was reached. There hasn't been a vote on that agreement, right? But the governor's already expressed his opposition to it.
Yeah, that's right. So last night there was the special committee that's been negotiating largely behind closed doors for the last several weeks to try to fix this major sticking point in the budget negotiations, which is over education funding. They announced they had struck a deal largely between House Democrats and the Senate Republicans. And now we're waiting to see that budget come to the floor for what will be a very dramatic vote, because what we're getting the sense here is that we don't even know if there's enough votes to pass this as an emergency measure, which is necessary because state funding, the funding for state government runs out at midnight tonight. And so to add to the drama, we have the fact that if they even are able to get the votes to obtain that threshold, that Governor LePage came out today and said that he opposes the budget, and but rather than veto it immediately, if they are able to get it to his desk before midnight, that he's going to sit on it for 10 days. And then that would mean there's going to be a government shutdown for at least 10 days. So, that's where we are. It's pretty quiet in the hallways right now. I think that's going to change, very soon as, state employees are starting to gather. I noticed a lot of purple shirts in the hallway. And, I think those people will be filling the hallways pretty soon, trying to exert as much pressure as they can to get.
And do you believe that vote will happen this afternoon, Steve?
It should. It's either later this afternoon or early evening. I think what they're waiting for is to get that budget printed. It is on the calendar. It's just a matter of, I think they also need to whip votes, frankly, and that's being done behind the scenes. And I think that once they think they have the support for it, they will run it, and we will see how it shakes out. I think a lot of the eyes will be on the House. I think the Senate, the votes are in the Senate to get this done, but it's the House that's really in question.
And when you say the votes are in the Senate to get this done, is that to pass it or to pass it by the two-thirds that would be a veto-proof majority?
Yeah, that would be the two-thirds. I think Senate Republicans had a press conference this morning expressing that they were united in support of this budget. Senate Democrats are also in support of the budget. I mean, I don't think anybody really likes it, but those two caucuses are at least ensuring that there will be a two-thirds vote. We don't know about the House Republicans, who have aligned themselves with the governor and were called to the Blaine House this morning to meet with him. And we don't know where they are. We haven't heard from Ken Fredette, who's the House Minority Leader. And there's some questions about the House Democratic Caucus, too. We don't know. I know that there's a lot of Democrats who are really unhappy that the budget repeals the 3% education surcharge, which was passed by voters in November. I think that some Democrats really feel like they gave up too much in this and that they may not be able to support it.
Greg, what does this say about our state government that we're at this point?
Well, I keep trying to think of a historical parallel and something that similar has happened in the past, and there just isn't any. I mean, we're in uncharted waters. The government shut down in 1991 over an issue. The governor wanted reform of the workers' comp system, but there is no issue this time. I mean, or it's a constantly changing cavalcade of issues. Like Steve said, the nut of it is school funding and the referendum that would have taxed the very wealthy. But there's something the governor is determined that he's decided that it's going to be, well, one day it's he wants to tax land trusts, and the next day it's no tax at all. And any tax that he'll veto any budget that has a tax on it. And to think that a governor, which has the word govern in it, would sit on a budget for 10 days and shut down the thing that he's supposed to be running is just bizarre. So I guess we're in a kind of in a off the map.
Off the map thoughts, Brian?
The quote that for me was the money quote this week was LePage declaring that he was I'm paraphrasing maybe, but the worst person in the world to play chicken with, which
yeah.
it just occurs to me. I have a hard time putting myself in the mindset of someone who thinks the fellow that doesn't budge in the game of chicken is the good guy. Like the nature of the game of chicken is that there are not really good guys involved. You know, the winner of the game of chicken is the person that's most willing to like ensure mutual destruction in order to prove that he's the bigger man, which is maybe like a characteristic you want in, I don't know, a gang leader or something. I can't really think of an example, but like you say, it seems like an odd thing for a sitting leader to thump his chest about.
Greg, your paper, the Portland Press Herald, has published a list of who and what may be affected if there's a government shutdown, but still a lot of questions. Steve, what are you hearing from your perch at the State House about what this means? Some courts open, some courts closed, game wardens and troopers working, but, child welfare workers, we're not sure?
Actually, we did get some news just just a moment ago, about there was a lawsuit filed, sort of a preemptive lawsuit filed yesterday in federal court that would wants to ensure that DHHS and services, applications for anti-poverty services, main care, food stamps, cash assistance, that those applications would continue to be processed and that the money would go out to those who need it. We've just heard that DHHS has assured the plaintiffs in this lawsuit that they will continue to process applications and send out checks. So that's one potential crisis averted. But if there is a shutdown, there is going to be a lot of lawsuits. I mean, back in 91, the last time this happened, there were dozens, and it was constant fielding of trying to determine what's an essential service. The attorney general had to weigh in at times, but in this kind of a situation, the governor really has a lot of latitude. He has a lot of power in a shutdown. He determines what stays open, what's closed. Look at this. For example, the governor has decided that state parks are going to stay open, which I don't believe that happened in 91. I think Governor McKernan did not leave state parks open, and that caused a lot of problems. This may save him a little bit of blowback, especially on a July 4th holiday, but there's going to be other problems. I mean, if this happens and he waits the 10 days, if it even gets to him, I mean, that's the big question.
Yeah. So, Greg, if it does get to the 10 days and the governor sits on it and then it eventually becomes the budget anyway, I know that's a lot of ifs, but what's the long game here? What does the governor gain by sitting on this budget for 10 days?
Well, he's got everybody looking at him for 10 days, which seems to be his usual need. He needs to attract a lot of attention to himself. He hasn't been able to achieve a lot on this legislative agenda. He hasn't gotten the kind of support he needed to get things up for referendum. He hasn't been able to, get his budget passed. So he will get everybody's attention. The bigger question for me is what's in it for the House Republicans? They are fighting tooth and nail for to cut taxes on the top 2% of income filers who largely don't live in their districts. These are talking about rural Republicans who are going to shut down the government to help, Cape Elizabeth lawyers who vote Democrat. So it's confusing.
And it occurs to me, again, in that fashion, that a game of chicken may be an inexact metaphor here, because in a game of chicken, the people who stand to lose the most are the players, of course. The bystanders tend to make it out pretty okay, notwithstanding the damage to their political reputations. Legislators and the governor are going to be all right. It's, you know, in the event of a shutdown, it's state workers and the people depending on state agencies that are going to suffer. So I don't know what the game is where two people head at each other headlong, and if they collide, they're okay and everybody else gets hurt. But that game would seem like a better comparison.
So this program is supposed to be the month in review, even though we could talk about the day in review, the hour in review for the whole program. And I want to go back a little bit, Brian. The Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke, visited Maine, toured Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument with Lucas St. Clair, met with lots of stakeholders in the region. And since then, has sort of been dropping, that day dropped some hints, hinting that perhaps the monument should not be a monument, but a national park. And then since then, dropping some other hints, a quote that was from June 20th. He says, "I'm sure you're going to be enthusiastic about the recommendations as well as the governor. I have talked to the governor, and I think we have a reasonable approach with the recommendation that all parties will be satisfied with. The governor opposes Katahdin Woods and Waters." What do these hints mean? Do we have any idea?
The secretary said that to Senator King in a hearing, and I find it a little bit inscrutable, but I do know, the nature of a national park is such is that it's designated by legislation and not by proclamation. And so one limitation that national monuments have is that an executive order is a concise document, and it's not a document that is a result of multiple parties sitting down at a table. The national parks have leeway. There are national parks that allow hunting, not a lot of them, but Denali and Grand Teton. And there are national parks that, have dams and certainly have snowmobiles and some other like allowances for motorized recreation. So it's possible, I'm completely speculating, that maybe the secretary sees an opening in a national park designation for more people to get what they want than currently exists with the national monument. That's a guess, but it is rather cryptic.
Steve, are you following this, or are you too? Been too deeply into what's going on inside the state house.
Well, no, I'm not as I haven't followed this as closely, but I have the same question. I mean, the governor's interest in this property has always been, I think, from a forest management perspective. In other words, cutting down trees. And I guess I kind of wonder. I don't have the breadth of historical knowledge about national parks to know if that's a use that occurs on national parks. But I just kind of wonder if a national monument can achieve, or excuse me, a national park could do that, and if that's the thing, in addition to having more access to hunting and snowmobiling and that sort of thing, if those are the things that would make him happy. I mean, Zinke went to the Blaine House and met with the governor before he even went up to Katahdin Woods and Waters. We don't know what was discussed there, but, if he's trying to strike a balance between those two things and he seems assured that the governor is going to be happy, you have to wonder if you're talking about increased use on there that's not just tourists and visitors, that sort of thing.
Of course, I do sort of suspect that there at least were at one time, and whether there still are or not, folks that were critical of the monument designation who maybe pay lip service to the notion of forestry on the land, but at bedrock have just an ideological opposition to federally managed public land. And the interesting thing about that, and what I was really curious to see with Zinke's arrival, is that this is a former legislator from Montana, which is where I lived before I fell in love with the Mainer, and is a place where historically even sort of staunch conservatives have a fairly comfortable relationship with the notion of federally managed public land. Montana is like 30% public land, I think, and it's certainly not a socialist dystopia. And he does not really represent the Cliven Bundy sort of wing, to the best of my understanding. And so I was curious to see what sort of common cause he was going to find with some of the louder opponents here.
And Greg, go ahead. Go ahead,
I was
Steve.
Just going to say, Brian brought up a really interesting point, which, you know, that, and he could probably speak more to this, but I was always fascinated by the fact that in Montana, I think the resistance to federal, to public lands is that the federal government takes it, right? And then in this case, it's been given to the federal government. And I wonder if that has made him, you know, Secretary Zinke, any more receptive to the idea of it being a national park or something different.
And Greg, a big unknown is whether the president will actually even go by the recommendations of his own Interior Secretary.
Exactly, right. We don't know that at all. I mean, what I'm seeing here is less ideology, Brian, than kind of tribalism. Just this sense that people who like this, I don't like them, so therefore I'm against it. And that seems to be what drives a lot of what the governor does. And it's also true of the president. So who knows?
Of course, I think that's been fading away a little bit in the wake of the designation, because the battle was, you know, sort of over. And I'd like to think that if, you know, those sort of more basic tribalistic impulses, people sort of set aside and say, all right, let's get down to business.
Yeah.
But now it's sort of rehashed.
Yeah, the impression I have is the people in the area have moved on, but the governor hasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, guess what? We have to take a break. We still haven't talked about Senator Collins, Senator King, ranked choice voting. So we will talk about those things when we come back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Highland Green of Topsom, proudly supporting Saturday Afternoon Opera, which airs tomorrow beginning at 1 p.m. on Maine Public Classical, and Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Next time you look up at the stars, think about this.
Inside you are the remains of a stellar explosion. You are made of stardust. And without the stars, there wouldn't be us.
I'm Guy Raz, the wonders of the universe and the people who still look up every night. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for TED coming up tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock and again Wednesday evening at 11.
Walden Woods, where Henry David Thoreau once roamed, faced global warming and development threats.
Walden is a symbol. If we can't protect the place that gave birth to the idea of conservation through Thoreau's writings, how can we ever hope to protect other places around the world?
Preserving and celebrating Walden on Thoreau's 200th birthday. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tune in to Living on Earth coming up on Sunday morning at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Month in Review. With me in our studio, Greg Kasich, the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Brian Kevin is here as well. He's managing editor of Down East Magazine. And joining us from our Augusta studio, Steve Missler. He's Maine Public's chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief. Give us a call and join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Let's talk about the high profile Senator Susan Collins has had this past week, especially, but really ever since President Trump was elected. But the ripples that went through Washington and through the country when she sent out her tweet was that Monday or Tuesday?
It was
that
Monday night.
Monday night that she would oppose the advancement of the GOP health care bill. And the tweet was, I want to work with Republicans and Democrats to fix the flaws in Obamacare.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's a huge thing for her to say. And it was a great moment. It's a historic moment, I think. I mean, people who have been watching Susan Collins for a long time. I read the letters to the editor as part of my job, and I get two streams of criticism consistently for her over the years have been people who say that she's not really a Republican, that she's a rhino Republican in name only. And then there's another group that says she's not really a liberal. She really just pays lip service to the things that we care about. And then she votes with the Republicans. And I think what she's shown over the last few months very clearly is that she is both a Republican and a moderate Republican. Mm-hmm. She is an old school New England moderate Republican who doesn't like high taxes and didn't like Obamacare, but she doesn't believe that she believes there's a civic responsibility that society has to take care of people who need it. And her coming out, I believe she's the only, or she was the first anyway, Republican to come out and say a bill that dumps 22 million people off health insurance is unacceptable. The other critics were coming from the other side saying it didn't go far enough. So the fact that she was able to make that case put sort of a fence around the issue. You know, this is the ground in which it'll be argued. And had she not come forward, it would have been purely on the other side.
Steve, what kind of reaction were you hearing in Augusta from Republicans who serve in the legislature?
I didn't hear so much from lawmakers here about her decision. I mean, what was interesting to me is that prior to her making that announcement, which she did via Twitter, which was interesting, was that, you know, the main Republican Party was basically was tweeting, had like a tweet storm of, you know, basically trying to discredit the Congressional Budget Office estimates of what would happen under this this plan. Basically trying to discredit the CBO's work, right? And then Collins comes out within minutes and cites the CBO analysis as one of the chief reasons as to why she cannot support this bill. I thought it kind of speaks to what Greg was talking about, where the party, I think, has drifted further right, especially with Governor LePage in the Blaine House, and really in control of the party in many regards, right? But what I've often wondered about is where can a moderate, you know, where do they live in this current climate, right? It just feels like everybody's moving farther to the left, everybody's moving farther to the right. And I just wonder if that ground that she's held for so long is sort of shrinking beneath her feet. But she doesn't seem to be disturbed by, well, she might be disturbed by that, but she doesn't seem to be afraid of that. And she's still sticking to, as Greg put it, you know, her principles. And I think that even her harshest critics have got to, you know, on the left, have got to give her some credit for that decision of the day.
Well, it's interesting to me, and I'll toss this one to you, Brian, because what I was seeing in social media was a mix of people saying, good for you, Senator Collins, good for you, thinking for yourself. But then a bunch of people, and really a lot of people that I saw on social media, still critical, saying too vague and too late, only doing this because she knows it doesn't have enough votes, things like this. And it occurs to me, and I was thinking about the polarization, and I'm wondering if there is a larger and larger group of people in which the distrust is so strong that it doesn't matter what she does. And switching that the other way around, it doesn't matter to conservatives what a Democratic representative might do.
Yeah, that's a fine question, and I don't know that I'm in any position to answer it. I'd like to think that's not the case. You know, I left a message on Senator Collins' voicemail the other week, and, you know, one of the things that I said was, I know, you know, there's talk of you mulling a run for the governor's office, and people are paying attention to your decisions. I like to think there are enough people out there that are engaged in this in an active way that, you know, the kinds of decisions that a sitting senator makes on high profile legislation like this has the potential to actually change, you know, their view. But who knows?
So, Greg, what about our other senator? I had to double check and make sure it was indeed this month
Senator
King was grilling the leaders of the U.S. security apparatus. And indeed it was June 8th, I believe, that, you know, Senator King's statements and actions in the Intelligence Committee were making national news.
Yes, that was a big moment, too. You know, he told me that since he's one of the more junior members of the committee, he doesn't get to ask his questions right away. And you can see when senators come to the committee hearing with a list of questions, their staff is prepared and just read it. And he instead, I think, listens to the other questions and answers. And what he was actually doing was following up with Admiral Rogers and the director of intelligence, Coates, saying, you know, why is it that you will not answer these questions? And it, you know, made for a pretty dramatic moment. just off the off the cuff, the Admiral Rogers actually was stationed in Maine at Cutler when King was governor.
Huh. Oh, so, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Other. Yeah.
And Steve, Senator King is saying he believes the investigation is maybe 30% done.
Yeah, the one thing I could just add to what Greg said, which was interesting about how he questioned not just the security apparatus, but Attorney General Sessions, is he really seemed to focus on something that sometimes seems to be lost in these in D.C., which is the idea that there was collusion between Trump officials and Russian officials in the election meddling. But he really seemed to focus on the fact that this was an attack, right? And that that was very serious. And he was just thought that he felt like that was being lost in all of this sort of, okay, the blame game, if you will, or lack of a better term, just that was the thing. Like he just sort of had this idea, the wherewithal to pull back and say, listen, this was an attack on our democracy, and this is very important. And, you know, and he also pointed out that the president doesn't seem to be disturbed by that, and neither does Attorney General Sessions. So I think he got a lot of national press out of that because he started talking about something that nobody else was during those hearings, you know. And so it was just very interesting in watching him grab the spotlight that way as well.
He told Bloomberg this last week, I think, or a couple of weeks back, that he was going to continue to sort of try and refocus the investigation on that point exactly and away from some of what he seemed to consider the sideshow. The headline on that piece, as I recall it, called him like a voice of reason rising from the swamp. I think one of the greatest things of the last couple of months has been to watch, media-wise, Charlie Pierce of Esquire's burgeoning bromance with Senator King, who he has dubbed the mustache of righteousness.
Oh my gosh.
Enjoyed that commentary.
I'd like to hear what Senator King thinks of that title. He probably likes it. Steve Missler, what's going on with ranked choice voting?
Well, that's a great question. So right now, there was a repeal effort, and then there was an effort to amend the Constitution, or at least put a constitutional amendment to voters. Neither one of those right now is going anywhere. And so what we're left with is current status quo. The law is in place. The state is under obligation to implement it, and that's causing a lot of heartburn, I think, for state election officials because they really need, because of the Supreme Court decision or rule opinion that said that the key element of this is unconstitutional. Matt Dunlap, the Secretary of State, and others believe that there needs to be something to fix that. Otherwise, the state is going to be opening itself up to lawsuits or, you know, there'll be a lot of legal challenges of election results. So I would not say that repeal is off the table. There's going to be some people who continue to push that, whether they do that next year, next session, or if there's a special session, which I wouldn't rule out given the current circumstances, you might see something there. There was some chatter about trying to put it in the budget. I don't think that's going to happen. But it's still very much in flux. And I think there are people that are opponents of ranked choice voting that are going to continue to try to scrap the law. And then there is others that want to try to defend it. And then there are others who just want to fix it so that, you know, that election results aren't challenged in court.
So here we are on the last day of the fiscal year, and we're talking about all the things we don't know what's going to happen next.
It's going to be a busy 6 hours or something. You know, one of the possibilities is there could be, if there's a repeal, there could be a people's veto on the repeal, which would probably go on the same ballot as next June's primary. First of all, it would stay the repeal law so that ranked choice voting would stay in effect. And then you would have a June primary where you voted on candidates and a people's veto that will determine how those votes will be counted.
Oh
right.
My.
So you would use the ranked choice system, and then you'd be also deciding whether you want to do that again. You know, it's just kind of, it would be an amazing
and if it's
thing
successful,
if that happens.
Yeah. And if it's successful, then you'd go into November with a voting system that is, in the opinion of the Supreme Court, unconstitutional in general elections.
I have to wonder how many people are asking themselves at this point how many ballot measures have to sort of not find their way into full fruition, coupled with a pending government shutdown before you start to think of like a crisis of the validity of your sitting leaders, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you have multiple ballot measures from one election that, you know, find their way into a situation where you have legislators and other elected officials saying like, you know, that's nice, but I think we know better. We're going to tweak it in this way. That's kind of a pen under the toenail of democracy in a way. It's not cutting off the toe, but it's not a comfortable position to be in.
Sure. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address talk@mainpublic.org. Before we go to the phones, though, Brian, I want to ask you about something I know you've been following. Really controversial decision happened up in Bar Harbor, whether or not to build a cruise ship terminal. I think it's hard for people who live in other parts of the state to realize what an impact, how many more tourists come to Bar Harbor than live in Bar Harbor every year. It's really astonishing, isn't it?
It certainly is. And I'd be curious actually to hear some callers weigh in on this because I have been following it at a remove. I'm obviously not on MDI, but we did a piece in it, on it for our upcoming issue. This next year is predicted to be across the state just an astronomical year for cruise ship traffic. The first one landed in Portland this month and then 2 weeks ago in Bar Harbor I want to say it was something like 60-40. After a lot of acrimony, the Bar Harborites decided to allow zoning changes that will allow for an old property, an old pier, to be sort of retrofitted, improved to allow cruise ships to come directly to port. Right now, a tender boat has to bring folks from where the cruise ships dock in the harbor. And depending on who you believe, it could increase cruise ship traffic by, you know, anywhere in the 150,000 to like 450,000, you know, people a year. And so that's a big change.
So 450,000 people a year for a small
community
town,
which granted has a lot of people coming to it already by other means, but something about those cruise ship passengers makes us riles us up in a way that people coming by car just doesn't.
Okay, we're going to go to Steve calling from Belfast. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I wanted to comment on the cruise ship question. In 1981, I was working in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands on the day when, for the first time ever, they had more than 50,000 cruise ship people come ashore in one day.
Wow!
And it is any charm left in Bar Harbor will be trampled out and made into T-shirts if they ever get to those numbers. It's pretty. And the other thing I wanted to comment on was that earlier, you were sort of deciding whether how what's going on in Augusta compares to playing chicken, and I think it's playing chicken with school buses full of kids is the actual illusion, or perhaps it's male animals with horns banging their heads together to decide who gets the girl.
Steve, thanks for your call. We do have to take another break. We'd love to hear from you in our last section of the program. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. We're talking about the month in review. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does the Dexter Group of Wells Fargo Advisors, investment advisory and asset management services since 1995, in Portland and at thedextergroup.us.
2 years ago, a Massachusetts man was arrested and charged with attempting to commit an act of terrorism. It was his father, a Boston police captain, who tipped off the feds. The young man is still in custody. His mother can't understand why.
He's very compassionate. He has a deep respect and reverence for all living things. I'm sure some people are out there saying, yeah, right, but he literally would not hurt a fly.
Alex Ciccolo's story on Next from the New England News Collaborative.
Join us for Next, coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
Former NFL player Ryan O'Callaghan was so traumatized by living as a closeted gay man, he planned to kill himself. Now he wants to help others.
Kids are still killing themselves. And there's someone like me who could speak up, help out, you know, be a good example. I'll do it.
His story and updates on the president's travel ban this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 this evening with Ed Morin.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, that news that made headlines in Maine this month. With me today, Brian Kevin, managing editor of Down East Magazine, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor of the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and joining us from our Augusta studio, Steve Missler, Maine Public's chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. So many other things happening, but Emily Kane, who lost to Bruce Poliquin in the 2nd District race, has now been appointed with a pretty big job on the national level.
Yeah, it's impressive to see her. She's the head of Emily's List, which recruits Democratic women to run for office. She is a very talented person with a lot of ability. Her electoral record is not that great. I mean, she actually lost two races here, including one race that she really ought to have won. It was a three-way race against Bruce Poliquin with a conservative independent in the race, a libertarian. I think she kind of highlights to me a lot of the problems that Democrats have in terms of determining what is the message that is going to help them take back the House of Representatives and who are the right kind of candidates. And certainly in the 2nd District of Maine, she was not the right candidate.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Eastport. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I have a question. Has anyone in Augusta ever thought of the practicality of having a 1-cent tax on everything and use it for schools? It's done in Kentucky, and no landowners pay school tax. And that is one of the things that's crippling this state, especially older people that don't even have children anymore.
When you say a 1-cent tax on everything, what do you mean? More so than sales tax?
On every dollar you spend. We were just talking about the cruise ships. How many people are coming into the state? How many people come up the turnpike? You know, it's vacation land. If you got 1 cent on every dollar they spend, which nobody's going to complain about.
Well, Steve Missler, I mean, the budget compromise is increasing the lodging tax, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's I think it's 8%. It was 8, and it would go up to 10.5 if I have that correct. I know it would go to 10.5. I'm not sure what it is now.
It's 9.
I
apologize
for that. 9. It was 8, and then it went to 9 a year and a half ago, and then going to 10.5, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and the idea behind that is to tax visitors. It's exporting the tax, as it were, because not that many people, that live in Maine, stay at a hotel in Maine. So that's the idea behind it. And, you know, I think the argument in favor of it is that, you know, if you're booking a vacation, do you ever look at the lodging tax until after you've already paid it, right? But I'm not familiar with the concept that the caller has brought up. I mean, I think that's essentially the sales tax. I mean, there was a discussion to. Yeah, right. So, we have one of those, and we've raised that, and there's been proposals to broaden which goods and services that it applies to. And if, you know, say golf tickets, for example, or ski tickets, or, you know, golf greens fees at golf courses. And those proposals just haven't gone anywhere. In fact, there was a people's veto back in 2009 or 10. I'm sorry, my memory's fading. But there was a people's veto of that, of a proposal that would have done exactly that. It would have, you know, broadened the sales tax base to include a whole bunch of different services and goods, and it was rejected. And Governor LePage actually proposed a similar concept in 2014, and that was I think Democrats were maybe ready to embrace it. They didn't really want to get behind it because of the experience they had in 2010, where that sales tax expansion was used against them in legislative races. But the people that really killed that were Senate Republicans. They just really opposed to it. And many of them won their seats based on running campaigns against the original proposal in 2009.
John, thanks for your call. We're going to move on. John, we're going to move on to Leslie calling from Bath. Go ahead, Leslie.
Thank you. Great program. And one of the things that I find most disturbing about this legislative session is the fact that the legislators feel compelled to overturn the will of the voters. And I guess the question that I have is, if Tabor had passed in the two tries that we saw, would the legislature be saying, oh, the people didn't know what they were doing, we have to fix this for them?
Interesting point, Greg.
I mean, something has really changed. I don't think there has ever been a legislature since term limits has passed where you didn't have a majority in both houses saying that how much they hate term limits and how they would like to overturn it, and they never touched it. I think it's been over 20 years. But I think, something has changed. I think it started when Governor LePage stopped issuing bonds that had been voter approved, and this notion that things that have been approved by the voters is untouchable, it just went out the window, and it becomes kind of the opening bid in a conversation.
Yeah, I think there is something going on. I mean, it seems as though, will of the voters has always been sacrosanct in American politics, right? And it's just that's not happening right now. And it's not just Maine. I mean, I've actually just filed a story for NPR that involves a station in California where a similar phenomenon is happening. And I don't know what it is, but, there's some different theories. I was speaking with Ann Luther from the League of Women Voters, who had some really interesting things to say about this to try to explain it. One is that she's noticed that, A, that legislators have taken a really provincial view of statewide things. So if voters in their district didn't, for say, question two or ranked choice voting, which was question five, then they don't feel like they have to honor those statewide results, that they can vote against it or vote to repeal it or significantly overhaul it or whatever. And then the other thing she said that was really interesting was that there was a sense that she picked up from talking to legislators, they just don't trust the voters anymore. And I don't know that that's the majority of the people in here in Augusta, but she said there were some that she talked to who just didn't trust the decisions that they had made. And she seemed to think that that has something to do with how wacky the 2016 election was and what happened. And so, I think there's a number of different factors that are at play here. And I don't know. I mean, the question is if voters hold these legislators, if they make them pay an electoral price, then maybe they won't do it again, right? But if they don't, then maybe they'll be emboldened to do this type of stuff again.
Leslie, thanks for your question. Another question from Bath, this time Joy. Hi, Joy. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. And actually, my question was exactly the same as Leslie's. And my follow-up to what your panel is discussing is there not some legality here or constitutionally that's being, how come the legislators can do what they want, and then when I hear that LePage wants to veto the bill because he doesn't want any more taxes, and we in his state of Maine have voted for this to help with.
Sure, I understand your question, Joy, and the answer is, Greg, is that a referendum question that passes is just like any other law, right? It can
That's
be
right.
amended and repealed.
Right. Some states you can amend the Constitution by citizen initiative, but in Maine it's just a law, and the way they can change a law that had been made by a previous legislature, they can change this one.
All right, Joy. Thanks for your question. We'll try to squeeze in one
Not
more
a very
question.
Satisfying answer.
Yeah, I know. It just seems like that is what it is right now. Margaret from Orland. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Getting back to the ranked choice voting. I read somewhere just a week ago about an amendment that was submitted by Representative Hickman that would separate the application of ranked choice voting to only those elections that are not main state elections, like for main states, Senate and House and governor.
And wondering about the fate of that amendment?
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve Missler, do you know the answer to that question?
Yeah, that was actually tacked on. That amendment was tacked on to the repeal bill, which is dead. It died between the bodies. There could be a chance that it gets not that bill necessarily, but a different bill that actually is the constitutional amendment. That could be resurrected, but I don't see that happening at this late hour, frankly. I think they're going to have to deal with this either in a special session or back in January of next year.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you metropolitan Mainers, me from up in Hope and the rural places, but do you not vote for a mayor of Portland using a ranked choice system, and other aspects of the ballot are using a conventional system?
That's right. Yeah, in Portland, we have ranked choice for mayor, and all other city council and school board are just first past the post. And we had the first election, we had 15 candidates, it took something like 14 rounds of counting, and nobody changed position. The person with the first, so there wouldn't have been a situation where anybody would go to court.
Does the experience of Portland? I'm curious to ask you and Steve. Anyone does the experience of Portland sort of put some of the fears to rest at the State Department about how complicated this will be?
It's no more complicated than saying, apple is my favorite fruit and I like blueberries second. it's a very simple thing that you do all the time, and the ballot is not that complicated to work with.
Well, on that note, I think everybody needs to get lunch. Margaret, thank you for your question. We are out of time. I do want to mention that Steve Missler will be back on Wednesday, and you'll help us make sense of everything that happens between now and then. So we look forward to having you back, Steve. Greg Kasich, the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Brian Kevin, managing editor of Down East Magazine. And Steve Missler, chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief for Maine Public Radio. Thank you all for being here. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.